Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
Natural disasters are nothing new.
Disaster in Asia. First, an earthquake of immense power shook the Indian Ocean.
Panic in the streets of Kathmandu after a quake toppled temples that stood for centuries, brought down buildings, and tore open roads.
Well, this is the headline in the Times-Picayune. Katrina takes aim. Takes aim on New Orleans. This is the worst-case scenario.
A powerful earthquake rocked Japan this morning, causing buildings in Tokyo to sway for several minutes. The quake triggered some tsunami waves.
But who is to blame when an earthquake, hurricane, or wildfire destroys lives and property? You're listening to Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. It's tempting and easy to answer that nobody is to blame. A terrible episode of weather or fire or seismic activity is clearly beyond human control. But the extent to which individuals suffer in the aftermath is shockingly correlated to how well they were doing before. And that is something my guest believes we have the power to change if we choose to care about it. John C. Mutter is professor at Columbia University with appointments in the departments of Earth and Environmental Sciences and in International and Public Affairs. His new book is The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. John, welcome to Think.
Oh, thank you very much for having me.
You write, disasters are not terrible for the reasons we are told they are. Will you explain that for us?
Well, generally speaking, what we hear about, particularly in the press, particularly the visual press, the television press, there's a terrible lot of focus on the buildings that are brought down, the amount of death, which of course is terrible. But what the real problem is the aftermath and how that period of time can be manipulated and how people in that period of time can either do well or do poorly or come out of it reasonably unscathed.
I hadn't thought much about this before reading your book, but in terms of the way we try to understand natural disasters, we tend to either look at the science behind them or we look at the social and economic consequences. Why do both of those approaches taken separately fail to give us a real picture?
Well, think about it this way, and you're absolutely right, that there are really two groups of people. One, the natural scientists, the people who, for instance, study earthquakes, are very interested in trying to understand earthquake risk, and people who study the climate and are interested in understanding how cyclones work and how they develop their path and particularly where they might, make landfall. And then when the event happens, there's a few days of coverage, and then the natural scientists sort of go away. Some will come and look at the assessed damage, but mostly it's over and done with for the natural scientist. And then the social scientist takes over and says, well, how is this society going to recover? Why was it as bad as it was? Could it have been not quite so bad? So there's a handoff between the natural scientist and the social scientist. And as an illustration of why there's some need to think across that sort of divide, if you think just about fatalities, you know that there have been earthquakes of approximately the same magnitude, say about 7, that in one country will cause hundreds of thousands of fatalities and tremendous damage, and in another country will cause very few casualties and perhaps quite a lot of damage. So, you know, the earthquake that hit Port-au-Prince is not very different in magnitude from the one that hit the Northridge earthquake in California. Yet 61 people died in Northridge, I think is the number. It's around that number. And in Port-au-Prince, the number is over 100,000. So the natural science can't tell you that. It can tell you how large the earthquake is, how long it's been since there was one, how much the earth moved. But being able to predict that doesn't predict the social consequence in terms of mortality to begin with, and secondly, in terms of economic losses and recovery possibilities.
It's surprisingly complicated to try to decide whether we should measure the damage from natural disasters in dollars or in human lives.
It's both appear in the media. So the first thing you'll hear about, which seems to be a measure of seriousness, is the number of deaths. And of course, deaths are always tragic. And even if it's not a very large number, it's still a tragedy if you know, 10 people die.
Yeah.
So that's what you hear about first. And then after a little while, you start hearing about what gets called economic losses, but truly they're not economic losses, strictly speaking, because they're losses of capital stocks, if you understand what I mean, buildings and roads and schools and bridges, etc. And an economy is both stocks and flows, production. So you can lose capital stock, and that may have a very large effect on production. You can lose capital stock, and it would have a small effect on production. So whether it sounds unfortunate or not, your home, unless you're broadcasting from your home, is not what economists would think of as productive capital, because you don't produce anything there. Whereas I presume you're sitting in a studio, and so am I,
mm-hmm.
and this capital is productive because things are being produced here.
So even though, for example, and this would be the case for anyone, if my home were destroyed, it would distract me at work. Maybe I wouldn't be such a good employee. None of that gets figured into the dollars and cents of the cost of
the disaster. Right, but you'd still be able to get to work, probably,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
So, however, if your workplace was destroyed, you're out of a job, potentially, particularly if you're a poor person. You're going to find it very hard to get another job.
Right. We tend to get these very quick and confident counts in media reports, and I would say I've probably repeated some of them in my own journalistic career. How are these human casualties and dollar losses calculated so quickly, and what do they tend to leave out?
So this is one of the reasons I sort of got interested in this in the first place, because, you know, I grew up as a natural scientist where we measure things and we get numbers and we get uncertainties and there's error distributions and we're very strict about that sort of thing. And I started to wonder how they made calculations of the number of people who died in a natural disaster. And I thought, well, this has got to be easy. You're just counting body bags, you know, how many people. But there's a couple of issues, many issues. One is, when do you start counting? Because people will, unfortunately, will die a few days before either trying to get away or trying to prepare their house to fortify it. So in Sandy recently here, a person died trying to cut down limbs off a tree that was overhanging their house. And that person was considered a Sandy victim, even though it happened the day before.
Hmm.
And the very same thing happened the day after, and that's also a Sandy victim because he was trying to clear stuff off his roof. So there's a, when do you start counting? When do you stop counting? And there's no agreed upon standard for that throughout this country and throughout the world. So you can't really compare, although disasters are frequently compared by number of fatalities. If everybody's got a different way of counting fatalities, how can you really compare? Now, the other issue is that a lot of people die from the exacerbation of pre-existing conditions. So if I have a very weak heart and I have to be evacuated or move quickly or do something that I'm not used to doing, that may well cause me to die. But the cause is heart failure, not drowning, not a building falling down on me. And many, many earthquake and other disaster fatalities come from the exacerbation of existing injuries. So some people will say, well, they would have died, and not injuries, illnesses. Well, people say, well, they would have died anyway, maybe even just a week later. So they shouldn't really be included. Only those people who drowned, got crushed by a roof, very, very direct, should be counted. And then, you know, there are many, many stories, particularly after Katrina, of particularly elderly people who faded quickly afterwards, people who perhaps lost track of their medication, didn't know how to tell a doctor how they should be treated. Also people who just sort of lost hope. You know, they wanted to go back to New Orleans. They found that they couldn't because their houses had been so completely destroyed, and lost heart and died. And there's a number of stories in the local New Orleans newspapers about people like that. So I think it likely that the number of people who die in disasters is a greater number than is reported, because it keeps happening. Now, the number that's reported, particularly if you were quoting the CDC, the Center for Disease Control, that's a very conservative number. And you can be certain that it is no less than the number given by the CDC. It could only be more than, just because they're very conservative.
What conditions might prompt some governments elsewhere to be less conservative and, in fact, inflate death casualty figures?
Yeah, so things happen both ways. And a lot of this is anecdote, and some of it's admitted, but very little is admitted on paper. Hmm. So you might say, well, what would cause a country to understate a death count? Well, it can seem as if you're, as a government, not in control of things if a lot of people die. It can seem like you're not ready, that you haven't evacuated properly, that you've allowed a lot of people to be vulnerable and you shouldn't have. So it's widely believed that the death toll from Cyclone Nargis in Myanmar, previously Burma, was quite a bit larger than what the government said. The government, it's thought, didn't want to look bad. Large casualties make you look bad. The other end is to somewhat inflate the casualties, because donors who provide money for relief are often influenced by the number of casualties. That's, for most donor agencies, that's a sort of metric of how bad the situation is, even though the money that is provided by donors is used for people who are alive. Hmm. The number of people who died tends to modify their thinking. John's- There's a lot of other factors. You know, people don't, like for us here, it depends how we think about that country. Hmm. I mean, how many of us would donate a huge amount of our own savings to a disaster that happened in Iran, for instance? Probably not so many. So it a lot of it depends on how one thinks about other countries.
John C. Mutter is my guest. He's professor at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. You can join our conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We'll return in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
The This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking today with John C. Mutter, professor at Columbia University with appointments in the Departments of Earth and Environmental Sciences and International and Public Affairs. His new book is called The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. You can be part of the conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. John, you look at disasters not as events, but as processes with three different stages. You alluded a bit to this earlier, but I wonder if you can talk about before, during, and after, and how they are presented to the general public who are not necessarily affected by the disaster of trying to understand it.
Yeah. So the way disasters are typically presented, it's simply the event of the moment. And because it's the most photogenic, the most interesting in some ways, the most dramatic. But what happens in that moment is previewed and rehearsed by things that happened before. Do you have a strong civil society? Do you have good instruments of government? Do you have good first responders? Have you paid any attention to building standards, etc.? So there's a long rehearsal to what actually happens at the moment of the disaster, the earthquake, the storm, etc. And following that, there's the period of recovery that the media seems almost uninterested in. From time to time, they'll go back, usually on annual anniversaries, to see how things are going, but the interest is much less. It's certainly much less among the public. So there's a three-phase process to it. There's the prelude, the thing itself, and then what happens afterwards. And what I've tried to argue is that the period of time in what happens afterwards can make a lot of difference to the outcome for individuals, not so much what happened in the event itself.
And that's where the profiteering happens.
Afterwards, yes.
Yeah. I think many people would assume, perhaps, that, you know, those with significant property and wealth would be more susceptible to capital losses from those who had very little. In fact, the opposite tends to be true.
That's true, because you've always got to think of it in terms of relative losses and in ability to recover. So if I'm a poor person and I lose a dollar, that may be a tragedy. And if I'm a wealthy person and lose $1,000, that may be nothing. And I may have the ability to recover that $1,000 very quickly. So the part of this where people get a little bit mixed up, and not just, you know, people who read newspapers, people in government and elsewhere, is that losses seem to be large in rich countries. That's simply because we've got a lot to lose. The value of our property stock is high, but that doesn't mean that we can't deal with it. We have insurance. We have a lot of other mechanisms by which we can deal with those losses. So it's not the loss. It's the ability to deal with the loss that matters.
One thing you say is that natural disasters essentially inconvenience privileged classes. They truly harm those below. So the recoveries play out differently. And in the end, the haves and have-nots are further separated than they had been before the disaster.
Yeah, that's you see that happening in a number of places. And since it's the anniversary year and month of Katrina, you know, one of the things that happened, if you look at the recovery map of New Orleans, think of it that way. If you look at the repopulation map, the wealthier areas, which were less damaged in the first place, have repopulated quite aggressively. They're in some parts, like the Central Business District, they're actually more populated than they were before. And the poorer areas, like the Lower Ninth and all the other places that are now famous in people's minds and unknown before, people have returned in far fewer numbers. Well, that's not because they don't want to come back. It's because the utilities are bad, that if they were insured, they had insurance on a place that had a very low value, but in order to replace where they used to live, they have to build buildings to a whole new set of regulations. Appropriately enough, perhaps, they have to raise them to a certain height, but that adds very much to the cost. Mm-hmm. So what small insurance coverage they might have had doesn't allow them to relocate. So they're scattered somewhere, and they've not returned. And so what you find with a place like New Orleans is that the average income appears to have increased. Well, that's because a lot of very low-income people have not come back. So if you do the arithmetic and you just, you know, the numerator is smaller and it's smaller, it is smaller, and the denominator, you've left out all the poor people. So naturally, it on average, it's going to look like people have improved their average income.
How should we think about what may be well-intentioned efforts to socially engineer communities like the Lower Ninth Ward of New Orleans after Katrina? Some people believe that although the destruction caused by the storm was unconscionable, it presented opportunities to start over, to make something better, to improve the schools. And you can argue all day about whether that actually happened. But is that morally right or wrong?
So it depends who you are. Mm. One of the problems, you're in Dallas. I was going to say, let's think about here. Hurricane Sandy was a terrific inconvenience to a huge number of people and a real problem for a smaller number of people, the people at Breezy Point, et cetera.
Right.
And if you go out to Breezy Point, which I did, you know, you look around, you're standing on the beach because there's nothing else to stand on, and you think to yourself, what should make people build a house here? It seems crazy. You know, surely they knew that this was going to happen. The problem is that, you know, they went to their local council and said, I want to buy land in this area. They were able to buy land from a real estate agent. The local council gave them permission. They had no signals at all that these were dangerous places to build, not the individual. So the person who sold them land didn't tell them. The local council didn't tell them. So nobody gave them any alert. And what's more, they know from people who've lived there for some time that, yes, there's been storms. Yes, they've come into the area where they've got their house. But what happened was a bit of flooding, a bit of inconvenience, and then the floodwaters went away. They couldn't possibly have known, an individual resident, I mean, that something like Sandy could happen. Now, we as scientists know it could because our time horizon is large. We were willing to look back tens of thousands of millions of years and see that very large events happen, but happen infrequently. So what bothers me sometimes is it appears as if it's the homeowner's fault. Like, what on earth were those people doing living below sea level in the Lower Ninth? Well, they were living there because they had no choice. Those are the marginal lands. Marginal people live in marginal lands. It's not a choice. The wealthier people had figured out where the places were that rarely flooded in New Orleans, and so they located their houses there. So there's an issue with, okay, I'm going to fix this, but I'm going to fix this at the detriment of a certain group of people, and it's almost always the poorer people or the people who've not been well advised.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Rock in New Orleans. Hi, Rock.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm from New Orleans, 13th generation. My family came to Louisiana in 1699. And so we've weathered hurricanes, you know, the French call it typhoon. And I went through Katrina, got hit by Katrina with my elderly parents. I flew in the day of the storm. I had already been hit in Miami the first time by Katrina. Got in with the two invalid parents, lost the house, my mother died. And I've seen firsthand what your guest is talking about, because we went from middle class to struggling. And there was no way to get anything repaired. And the insurance companies denied coverage. There was no health care. I'd have to take my elderly father, and we'd sit on the floor in some building, 100 people in the hallway waiting to see a doctor. And it took 5 or 6 years, and then the city started to come back, and I'm really thrilled that it looks so beautiful, and the way I remember it as a child and the way my whole family has known it for 300 years. But we're all just on the verge of being displaced, because you can't afford to buy a house anymore. Mm-hmm. It is gentrified. Right. And I'm really glad that your author, the guest, is here to talk about this, and I definitely am interested in the book. But I will take exception with one thing he said, because I know people that I practice law with who had 14 feet of water in their house, beautiful sections, fancy neighborhoods, along the lakefront, along the bayous, uptown. So it impacted everybody, but it brought everybody down economically. And of course, the poorer people in the Ninth Ward. I have a Creole mother who's from the Ninth Ward. And I'm a white guy, but I had a Creole mother. And so they had just lived there for hundreds of years. And it really was the failure of the government to maintain the levees and then step in and help us. But it's an emotional issue for me, because, you know, we're approaching the 10th anniversary.
Yeah.
And I'm glad that you brought this to everybody's attention.
Well, Rock, thank you so much for your call. I'm sorry to hear, really, about your family's ordeal, and you stand for so many other families. Did you hear anything there, John, that you wanted to respond to?
Yes. So a couple of things. First, thank you. Your story has many authors. Others could retell a story very close to the narrative you've told us. It's sad. What you say about the wealthy areas being just as flooded, it's true. The Lakewood area was underwater about the same amount as the Lower Ninth, Tremayan around there. What I'm particularly interested in, if you were listening in the earlier part of the show, is who can recover, who can get back to where they were. And it's the wealthier people who can get back to where they were, not the poorer people. And I'm very interested in the other thing that you said, that, you know, people will begin middle class and end up a class down. And that's very, very typical, particularly people who are living on the edge of, you know, just above, just struggling, just getting there. They can't take a mild blow, let alone a Katrina blow.
Let's talk about this issue of profiteering, because you mentioned that there were people who kind of came in and bought up land that people couldn't afford to repair or move back into. What are we to think of those who have the means to buy up distressed properties and ultimately benefit from the fact that there was a natural disaster?
I think if the first thing in their mind is the people who suffered, and their first instinct is to say, there's people who've been severely impacted in this area. First thing I have to do is help them, not buy them out, because that doesn't necessarily help them.
Right.
Not tell them they can't rebuild, because that won't necessarily help them. Don't tell them that this area looks like it'd make a nice golf course, you know, where they used to live. Put the social focus on rehousing the people who lost their houses. Now, it won't necessarily be in the very same place. I've talked to a lot of people who were displaced from New Orleans who want to come back to New Orleans, but they don't necessarily want to come back to the same street address they lived at. They'd be happy to be in a safer place, but still in New Orleans. So the social engineering you have to think of is not well, it would be lovely to have a country club and other things in this place where there used to be crummy old housing. You have to think first about the people most impacted, not the people who are most able to benefit.
For that to happen, does there have to be legislation to set people in the right direction? Can we rely on sort of the ethical nature of people, or is that a bad way to go?
I wish we could. In some places, of course, you can. Some places people have acted quite well. But very often there's a powerful elite, a government elite combined with wealthy business elites, and they basically run the planning process for the city. And they basically say, well, you know, we'll remake the city this way. And poor people have very little say in this, because they're not part of that elite and they don't have a voice, or not a strong voice, not as strong a voice as you'd like them to have.
I want to talk about Japan. Certainly no one would say Japan thrives because of natural disasters, but it is certainly a country that has, it seems, more than its share. It gets typhoons and earthquakes and tsunamis and volcanoes, remains relatively prosperous when compared to other nations around the globe. Why?
Yeah, practically the only thing they don't get is drought. And beyond that, they can't really feed themselves. Japan needs imports of all sorts of food in order to feed the population. The Japanese have always been extremely serious about earthquakes. That's what they consider their number one hazard.
You know, let me jump in here because we have to take a quick break, and I want to give you plenty of time to answer here. My guest is John C. Mutter, professor at Columbia University and author of a new book called The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. Join the conversation by emailing think@kera.org, by sending me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think, or by calling 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, here this hour with Columbia University Professor John C. Mutter, who has appointments in the Departments of International and Public Affairs and Earth and Environmental Sciences. His new book is The Disaster Profiteers: How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. John, before the break, we started to talk about what I suppose is the paradox of Japan and the fact that it is very susceptible to many kinds of natural disasters. Its economy does not seem to be particularly adversely affected. And you were starting to say that Japan is particularly well prepared for the possibility of earthquakes.
Yeah, so the paradox here is that although you might intuitively think that a country that has a lot of disasters might be particularly imperiled by them, what happens is that they don't get used to them, but they get used to having to deal with them. And the more they have to deal with them, the better they get at dealing with them. So there's these iconic pictures of Japanese school children hiding under their desks in order to avoid being injured during earthquakes. They're very good at earthquake engineering, building buildings to withstand earthquakes. And they have a long written history. So they know how earthquakes have affected them historically. It goes back a very, very long time, hundreds of years. So, for instance, the difference in Port-au-Prince in Haiti is that the last time they'd had an earthquake of that sort of magnitude, it had been 200 years. And there was no, barely a written record of that ever having happened. So nobody knew anybody who'd ever experienced an earthquake. In Japan, everybody knows somebody who's experienced an earthquake. So once you have to deal with them, you learn to deal with them. Volcanoes are less important.
Is there something we could learn from Japan with regard to eliminating the class-based or socioeconomic-based gaps in how people recover from earthquakes?
Yeah, it was interesting. One thing that always happens, or almost always happens, is that at some point there is news reporting of antisocial behavior, typically looting, people stealing from other people's houses or shops in particular, and not just stealing provisions, but stealing items, you know, electronics, etc. Very little of that was reported in Japan, and it sounds like it didn't happen. Now, there may be a couple of reasons for it. It may be that the place was so devastated that there was nothing left to steal. And it may be that it's just in the Japanese character that you don't do that. So there's something about the way the Japanese interact with each other that gives them some form of solidarity and willingness to work together. Now, they're very, very critical of their government, but they don't turn that into local squabbles. They think the response wasn't quick enough, and they are very, very critical of the continuing issues with respect to the nuclear power plant, with respect to Fukushima. And they're wondering when they're ever going to get back to that area, if at all. But they don't seem to experience the same level of social hostility that other countries seem to.
In this country, there is not only the issue of social class, but also of race as a predictive factor in how resilient people are able to be after disasters.
Yeah, well, of course, the two are so often correlated.
Yeah.
You know, in the poor parts of New Orleans, it's also dominantly black. I don't think black people are any worse at recovering than white people. They might even be better. But they're disadvantaged in the job market is what happens.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. You can also reach us via email to think@kera.org. When people are trying to understand how to make an entire community resilient after disaster, understanding that there will be poor people and rich people and middle class people, are there things that particular communities have done or could do to protect everyone?
Ooh, that's a hard question, because the wealthy tend to self-protect because they have the ability to do that. And poorer people look to their local councils, their governments, to make sure that, depending on what sort of event you're talking about, to make sure that the shoreline is properly fortified and roads don't wash out, and if things are broken, they get fixed quickly. So I think that so much of it comes down to the collective action of people and the action of governments. And in our country, of course, we're very democratic, and we're very much, we put a lot of store on the individual. So a lot of volunteers went to New Orleans to try to help, which is laudable, but a bunch of volunteers is never going to rebuild New Orleans. Only government has the money to do that. So it's a wonderful thing that people want to help. It just can't fix something as bad as Katrina. It can fix smaller things, but nothing that bad.
What's the effect of the, I would imagine it's a boon to job markets in the immediate aftermath, in the rebuilding phase?
In the rebuilding phase, yes, things have to be rebuilt. Some things really quickly. Some things you should think about and they'll take longer, like a charity hospital in New Orleans is being rebuilt, but it takes years, right? Now, there's always an immediate building boom, which helps the building industry. And there's nothing improper about that unless people put in overly high bids, which often happens, but or no bids at all. You know, a lot of it's done with no bid contracts. But that should be short term. And the problem with it from the point of view of the local industry is that a lot of the people who come in and do the rebuilding are not from the local area. And they're not bringing materials from the local area. So they're actually, you're sort of outsourcing your rebuilding. And it doesn't help the locals get back on their feet, the local businesses get back on their feet. So somebody from Virginia is likely to get the contract to do work in New Orleans, not somebody from New Orleans.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Let's go on the phone now to Sheila in Greenville. Hi, Sheila.
Hi, Chris. My question for Mr. Mutter is, is it an efficient use of relief funds when, like after Katrina, Oprah and different celebrities and business owners in the area wanted people to give to new houses being built? The lowest price on some of these ads would be $50,000, maybe $80,000 for the cheapest house. These were to be for low-income wage earners, and I just thought it was very self-serving of the owners to say, please build these houses so we can pay some low-wage earners and they have a place to live. Do you think that's an efficient use of relief funds? Because it just really bothered me.
Try to understand your question. So Oprah donated her own money? Is that the...
No, different groups were pushing for people to give. They would run ads in magazines and on TV, and they would show the houses and the cost of what would be built for low-wage earners.
I see. To my point of view, I don't understand very well the involvement of celebrities in disaster situations, and it happens almost all the time. You know, they'll have a concert, and I know this may not be answering your question directly, and, you know, are we to think that a disaster is particularly serious because Madonna had a concert? It sort of doesn't make much sense, and it'll raise a certain amount of money, but who does it go to? Do they send it to the Red Cross, to individuals, to who? It's a very odd way to go about thinking about disaster relief. And I think what you're describing is an odd way to do it as well.
If you look at, you know, providing brand new housing for a certain percentage of people who maybe didn't have insurance and were affected by this, recognizing that you can't possibly do that for even a small majority of the people who were affected, is there a benefit to that, to suddenly sprinkling in a few hundred new houses in this area that's really been devastated?
I think if a place like New Orleans is worth preserving, and I think it is worth preserving, you should do everything you can to preserve it. So there's a barrier now built out into the in Mississippi that should mitigate storm surge, which was the problem all along. The levees are being fortified properly, hopefully. And there are ways to think about where you should put housing and what that housing should be like to minimize the risks. I think that should be done if it can be done. On the other hand, I really don't know what to do in Port-au-Prince. I don't know how to make Port-au-Prince safe. If another earthquake of that magnitude happens in Port-au-Prince, exactly the same thing is going to happen. And I've no idea what you could do in order to prevent it from happening unless you make the country very much more wealthy so that the housing stock is much stronger.
Is the problem in part that Port-au-Prince was, and Haiti altogether, was incredibly poor before this earthquake happened? So there wasn't,
yes,
even if you talk about rebuilding, you're rebuilding to a standard of deep poverty.
Yes. The problem with Haiti, in fact, a lot of people like to say, well, you know, they didn't have any building standards. They did have building standards. They were just unenforceable because they don't have a government that functions properly. So everybody tries to build a house for as little money as they can pay. They have very little money and they want to spend as little as they can for a house. And that means all sorts of compromises in the mixture that makes up the cement, the rebars that hold the columns together, the roofing, everything. So you make a very fragile place, just like many of the buildings in China, what often got called tofu buildings that just collapsed just because they're so weak. So you could say, does Haiti have a building stock problem, or does it have a poverty problem? I think it has a poverty problem, and from that, a building stock problem arises.
How can we shift to a mindset that causes us to treat all human victims of disaster as equally important and equally worthy of help?
That's the best question that I've heard so far, and it's one that I wish I had an answer to. But the short response is that is the objective we should be working towards. I can't give you a clear policy way of doing this. Remember, this is going to be different in every country in the world. But it's a human rights issue. It's a right to housing. But it's not thought of that way. I think we have to try somehow to remove the grip of the sort of government business elite that captures the territory after these things happen and say, we're going to rebuild this way and that's going to be to our advantage and you're going to have to go somewhere else because you shouldn't have lived there in the first place.
John C. Mutter is professor at Columbia University and author of the new book, The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Disasters Make the Rich Richer and the Poor Even Poorer. John, it's been a really interesting conversation. Thank you so much for making this time for us.
Oh, thank you. And I hope it cools down there after a while.
We hope so, too. It usually happens in a month or so.
Think
is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered today by Justin Martin. Lindsay Connect is associate producer with help on the phones from Jose Carrion. Our executive producer is Jeff Whittington. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think. The show's email address is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.